Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Friday, October 11th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about Jason Reitman's new movie, Saturday Night, and then we'll present interviews with Jason Reitman, co-writer Gil Keenan, and some of the movie's cast members. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editor Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
And also, Slash Film staff writer Ryan Scott.
Hey, everyone. How's it going?
Ryan, I called you in here because my plans to see Saturday Night were thwarted because the two closest theaters near me were still closed because of the hurricane. And even though, thankfully, things were not bad in my area of North Florida, a couple of businesses were closed and shuttered up and stuff like that. So I still haven't seen this movie, but the two of you have. So I thought that you both could tell me a little bit about it for a few minutes before we get to Brad's interview. So obviously, Brad is a huge SNL fan. He's talked about that a bunch.
What?
But Ryan, what is your relationship to Saturday Night Live?
I think mine is probably the average relationship to Saturday Night Live for someone who particularly enjoys comedy and gets obsessed with like movies and stuff young, which is to say that like I probably enjoy it more than the average person, but I've kind of had an on and off relationship with it over the years. And I got to say, my relationship to it has dipped off mostly by NBC's own doing because I'm not going to pay for Peacock and it used to be on Hulu. So like, I don't really watch it anymore, but that's not, you know, like I would if it was more accessible to me, but in any event,
to be fair, just so you know, Ryan, they release every single sketch on YouTube now.
Yeah, I know they do, but I just kind of want to watch the episode, you know what I mean? I just want to be able to throw it on. And but anyway, yeah. So I watch some sketches here and there when people say like, here's a good sketch, but I still like, I watched the new Lonely Island thing recently, which was great. And but anyway, this to say, like, I have very fond memories of SNL, and you know, the stuff that I love dearly. But yeah, not like as I couldn't claim that I'm on Brad's level by any means.
Yeah, very few people are when it comes to SNL. Okay, so I guess general thoughts. Well, Brad, I was going to go to you. I guess you just gave me your general thoughts about this movie on, what was it, yesterday's episode or maybe the day before. Earlier this week, you talked about seeing the movie. So Ryan, I'll go back to you again. What was your reaction to seeing Saturday Night?
So I had a somewhat odd situation with it in that it was one of the secret screenings at Fantastic Fest this year, and so it was twofold. I was super stoked for the movie based on the trailer and stuff, and I always joke that I love movies about how stuff happened, but it also just wasn't the kind of thing that I was expecting to see at Fantastic Fest, and it was very late, so I was tired, and I was like, oh, okay, all right, you know, and I was kind of trying to get my head around it. Ultimately I liked it. I did. I think it was one of those things where I need to see it again because my expectations were so high that it was almost impossible for that first viewing to meet those expectations. But I did come down liking it and sort of bewildered by how good every single member of the cast is. And we can get into that more in a minute, I guess. But that was my big thing. It's just everyone who was hired to portray someone in this movie did a ridiculously good job.
Awesome. Okay, so I guess let's put up with a little bit of a spoiler warning here. I'm not going to ask you guys to go too in-depth because I personally still haven't seen this movie and kind of want to go into it without having like every single moment ruined for me. But I do want to open it up to you both if you want to talk about specific scenes or specific performances or anything like that that you wanted to highlight here. So Brad, you gave me your overview about this movie and how much you really, really loved it and said that it might be your favorite movie of the year so far. I just kind of want to open the floor to you to just talk about any aspect of the movie that you wanted to highlight here. So what stood out to you about this film?
Yeah, so first of all, I just want to commend the incredible way that Jason Reitman captured the spirit of Saturday Night Live with the energy of this movie, because the way he wrote it, the way he shot it, the way he designed how the narrative unfolds, it all feels like it's moving with the speed of a bullet train. It's almost real time, essentially, the 90 minutes before the first episode of SNL. So it's all behind the scenes. They completely recreated Studio 8H based on the actual blueprints of this location in 30 Rockefeller Plaza where Saturday Night Live was shot and still is shot every single week. And they created a set with no edge of frame. So it is a full recreation of Studio 8H so that they could shoot anywhere. They have the lighting design so that it can it's bright enough to shoot in. And the way the camera just weaves all throughout the maze that is Studio 8H is mesmerizing. He does several very long single take sequences with characters walking in and out all over the place. It always feels like there's some sense of chaos, of everyone scrambling at the last minute to make this show work. And you feel it in every single moment. There's a countdown that happens with like bumpers in between certain scenes. You have a character who is Lorne Michaels, the executive assistant played by Andrew Barth Feldman from No Hard Feelings, who comes in every now and then and says like 45 minutes, you know, and it's just never ending. And you know, so that on top of just having an incredible ensemble cast that has managed to not just do broad impressions of the famous people we know from Saturday Night Live, but like give nuanced impersonations. And each of them also gets like a time where things slow down a little bit and you have a moment to reflect on them as characters. And if the movie has one shortcoming, and it's not even a big one, it's that I wish we had more time with them as characters. But with so many moving pieces, Reitman and Gil Keenan, who co-wrote the script with him, did such a nice job of letting each character kind of have at least one touching, thoughtful, introspective moment about where they're at, like in their career, what's happening at SNL, what's happening in their personal lives. And so it has a little bit of a dose of heart to it, along with representing this chaotic spirit that SNL has always had. And so it's just, yeah, I've seen this movie twice now, because I got to see it before Toronto, so I could do interviews, and then I went to the premiere at the Toronto International Film Festival. And both times I was just like in awe watching it, because it's just full of energy, and I could not get enough of it. For somebody who is a diehard SNL fan, it is basically like the movie that I dreamed of. And as an SNL purist, because I've heard some people who are diehard SNL fans like me complain because there are a variety of things in it that are inaccurate, that didn't really happen the way they do in this movie. They didn't happen on the night of the premiere. And for me, I think that a lot of movies that recreate things that happen in real life add those moments of dramatization. You conflate certain scenarios to add a little bit of drama to it. And that's what's done here. And even some of the bigger gripes that people have, like especially with Jim Henson being portrayed as kind of this humorless dork, which he wasn't, but he took Muppets very seriously. But the Muppets were also kind of like scorned on the set of SNL because the writers couldn't really figure out how to write for them. Jim Henson did have specific ideas for how they should be portrayed, even though they were meant to be adult, you know, humor Muppets and things like that. For me, the way Jim Henson was portrayed in this movie, it's more about the vibe of how SNL viewed Jim Henson as opposed to intentionally being this accurate representation of who Jim Henson was. And to me, like that's kind of like what the idea of the entire movie is capturing the vibe of Saturday Night Live, what the writers and cast and crew felt during this time. And it works immensely well for doing something like that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I saw an interview with Jason Reitman on Instagram or something, some little reel or whatever, where he was talking about how he and Gil Keenan like interviewed a ton of people who were actually there on the night, and how this movie is a big, like a collection of their memories, basically. So that makes a lot of sense, the way that you're framing that in terms of like, this is how the people who were there in the room on that night felt about X, Y, or Z aspect. But
that's sort of... To my point with like a biopic sort of thing, or like a historical documentation of a thing, like I love that Steve Jobs movie from I think it was 2015, but that it's like those three events, like Steve Jobs' life didn't all unfold at those three events, but it's like a portrait of the man sort of painting him semi-accurately through these fictional things. And I think that like on a lesser scale, Saturday Night tries to paint a picture of what it was like that first night, even if not every single element of it is like a painstaking recreation. And I really appreciate that approach. Mm. And in particular, like Jim Henson, I love the Muppets and I love Jim Henson. So I was feeling a little precious about that. And one of my biggest takeaways is that Nicholas Braun, for the somewhat limited screen time he gets as Jim Henson, nails Jim Henson. And even in that Jim Henson documentary that's on Disney Plus, they do touch on the things Brad talks about, which is, yeah, like they didn't know how to treat him. They sort of didn't care for the Muppets. So I think that like the broader portrayal of what they're trying to get across there totally works. And it just gets the idea that the cast is so good. And I just want to shout out, I echo so many of Brad's thoughts, even if I don't feel as strongly about the movie as he does. But like Dylan O'Brien to me has been one of the most like underappreciated actors we've had for a long time. Like he should be such a movie star right now. And what he does as Dan Aykroyd in this movie is such proof of that. Like it, you know, and I think what he does and what everybody does, it's not like trying to nail like an impersonation. They really are trying to embody the person in a way that feels super respectful and impressive. And I don't know, I just, that's where I come back to, like, if you're going to do this, like getting that cast together is the reason to watch this movie and to sort of see someone embody young Chevy Chase the way that like Corey Michael Smith does. It's, to me, that's really where the money's at here. And it is nice to see Jason Reitman go back to this kind of movie, I guess, is really my big takeaway.
Mm. So Brad, did you have a standout performance that you wanted to highlight?
I mean, Ryan is absolutely right. Dylan O'Brien really is fantastic as Dan Aykroyd. He has that, like, that fast talking cadence down where he's like a little bit dorky, but a little bit cool. There's also an interesting moment that I asked Dylan O'Brien about in the movie where, you see like very briefly, like kind of like a moment of shyness and awkwardness from him, during a key scene where they're rehearsing for a sketch. And so I'll let you guys hear about that when I talk to him about it, in the interview. But like, Corey Michael Smith is also fantastic as Chevy Chase. The way he embodies Chevy Chase's, cocksure attitude, being fully arrogant, being, you know, more than a bit of a dickhead. He's fantastic. And honestly, he's one of the characters who I think gets the most time to like really dig into as like knowing what his career would become, knowing who he is. And like, you get to see a little bit of like when there's some insecurity there. And there's also a fantastic, scene with Tracy Letts, who plays, Herb Sargent in the movie, who's one of the SNL writers, where Chevy Chase has just kind of gotten a little bit of a boost, from after having a conversation with Willem Dafoe, who's one of the executives who's kind of overseeing, SNL at the time. And he's feeling very confident in himself and like where his career is headed. And this is just the beginning of something. And Herb Sargent, sarcastically, but also rather accurately, provides this prediction of how Chevy Chase's career and life is going to go. And as you listen to it, it's very close to like what Chevy Chase would become, at the time. And it's a little bit harsh. It's a little bit hilarious. Definitely accurate, but it's one of those great moments. But honestly, everybody, you know, Ella Hunt does a fantastic job as Gilda Radner. Matt Wood does a good job of capturing this like tortured artist and like a little bit on the edge of having just like a full breakdown, you know, of John Belushi. Lamorne Morris as Garrett Morris is, you know, incredible as well. So like everybody has a great part. Cooper Hoffman too, I think he's not going to get like a ton of accolades for this performance because it feels like it's just an average performance because he's just the straight man trying to keep Lorne on track and keep everything together. But he's so good at playing Dick Ebersol, who's one of the producers of SNL and would go on to take it over for the tumultuous 80s years after Lorne Michaels left. Yeah, honestly, like there's so much I could say about every cast member in this movie. And least of which is not Gabriel LaBelle, who I think I said in the past episode, like, I can't wait to see what this kid does with his career because he's already played Steven Spielberg. Now he's played Lorne Michaels.
He's so good.
He is. And like the best thing is like, he doesn't do like what you would expect of like trying to do a Lorne Michaels impression. Like, oh yes, we have Saturday Night Live. And so I also talked to him about that in the interview that I did with him and Rachel Sennett and Dylan O'Brien. So yeah, I can't sing enough praises about how incredible this ensemble cast is.
Yeah, since you brought up Rachel Sennett, I will say that this is my favorite performance of hers to date that I've seen. And then also not super advertised, J.K. Simmons, I won't say anything else, MVP for what little time he's in this movie
yeah.
for.
A total scene stealer. He is
total, just awesome. Incredible stuff from, but yeah, truly like, it's one of those movies I'm sort of dying to see again, because I feel like this is going to be a weird thing, but like, I feel like the 2018 Halloween movie, I was so like vibratingly excited about at the time. And then when I saw it also at Fantastic Fest, I came out of it knowing that I liked it, but had a hard time processing it. And then when I saw it the second time, I was like, oh, I love this movie. And I almost have the feeling that that's what's going to happen with this movie as well. And so I'm kind of dying to see it again.
Okay, before we go to the interviews, I wanted to ask Brad if there were any SNL Easter eggs that you noticed that maybe people should be looking out for. I'm sure you could probably pick out a ton, so maybe just a couple that immediately jumped out to you.
Yeah, so I'm sure there's a bunch that are littered through, because I did talk to Jason Reitman about this, because the one that there's two that I specifically noticed. One was easy to spot. The other one, you kind of have to look for it. The first one is, and it's rather prominent if you look in the background during a scene where Lorne Michaels is talking to Andrew Barth. Lorne Michaels is talking to Neil Levy. It's Gabriel LaBelle and Andrew Barth Feldman. You see the Landshark prop being rolled in the background, which is the sketch where Chevy Chase would voice a shark that would try to trick people into answering the door so that he could eat them at the door. And so that's something that wasn't part of the premiere episode of Saturday Night Live, but it would premiere in a later episode in the first season. One of the sneakier ones I notice is there's a scene where some of the writers are talking to each other. I want to say that it's Tom Davis and Al Franken who are talking to somebody else. And one of them reaches into a box of cereal that's sitting on a desk. And that cereal is Colon Blow, which is from the famous commercial parody in the 90s where Phil Hartman played a guy who's being told about this crazy new high fiber cereal called Colon Blow. And so then I asked Jason Reitman about that, because that's the one I noticed. And he said that there's also bottles of Swill somewhere, which is another commercial where they took water from like Lake Erie and bottled it as mineral water. What was the other one that I was just thinking about?
I was wondering if there would be like a llama walking by in the background or something, you know, like something from the modern era.
The llama is prominent in in this movie. Yeah, like you see it a few times. There's even a moment when Andy Kaufman like straight up talks to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah. I mean, my understanding is that the llama thing, from what I know, is like...
Oh, the Bass-O-Matic blender is apparently somewhere in the set as well. Reitman didn't tell me specifically where those are, and he said there are more. But like, it's the way the camera moves, it's like so fast that like you're probably going to really just have to like sit and like pause and look at the background to like pay attention to all the details that are there.
Okay. The llama thing. I mean, I don't know a ton about SNL, but I remember looking this up one time that like, why the hell does there always seem to be a llama going on, you know, wandering around in the background or something? And I guess that came up around like the early to mid 2000s or something. And there's always like a Lincoln, a llama and a showgirl wandering around in the background or whatever. So I was wondering if that was part of what people were complaining about or something in terms of the, not accurate to the period kind of thing, if they like threw in some of those more modern things just to kind of, I don't know, tip their cap to the legacy of SNL or anything like that.
Yeah. It's not as obvious in your face as it would seem. Like there are a couple references to sketches that wouldn't air until later in the season. But one of the things that's interesting that like kind of explains how that would be possible, even if those sketches weren't meant to be part of the premiere episode of SNL, is as they talk about in the movie, the dress rehearsal for the premiere episode was 3 hours, which is more than double what the actual length of the show is supposed to be. So wow. they had to cut a ton of stuff from that first episode. So they could have easily had those sketches like waiting in the wings, you know, which ones are we going to use? And then they were just saved and they were used for later episodes, which is something that still happens to this day. Sketches can be cut even as the show is airing. And if they're live, then they could be saved for another time for another host. If they're pre-tape, they could also potentially be saved. So it's like, that's something that just goes back all the way to the beginning of SNL's history.
Cool. All right. Well, any closing thoughts, Ryan, on Saturday night before we jump to these interviews?
Only thing I will point out, because I honestly don't think casual viewers are going to realize it, the same person plays Jim Henson and Andy Kaufman in this movie. It is the same actor. And it's really impressive because those are two very, very, very different people. And yeah, that speaks volumes about Reitman's ability to cast.
Yeah, actually, so Benny Safdie was the one who was supposed to play Andy Kaufman, and he had to pull out at the last minute. And so the solution that Reitman came up with was to have Nicholas Braun play both Jim Henson, who he was already prepared to play, and then Andy Kaufman.
Wild. Okay, let's take a break, and then we'll come back and get into Brad's interviews.
Just got a free coffee with my EarnIFI points.
Your what?
The points I get with the new EarnIFI app from BP and Amoco. I got 250 for signing up and more every time I fill up or buy anything in the C-store.
Oh, can you use points for fuel?
Of course.
And discounts and deals?
On anything.
Oh, like chips?
Mm-hmm.
Sodas?
You got it.
The actual slushy machine.
Only what's actually for sale. But you do get double the points for the first 90 days. Just go to EarnIFIRewards.com to download the app.
Available at participating locations only. App content is subject to change.
All right, first up, Brad had a chance to speak with the director of this movie, Jason Reitman.
Jason, man, let me first tell you that, like, this is the Saturday Night Live movie of my dreams. I'm a diehard fan, and, like, watching this was incredible to behold. It's everything I ever wanted from an SNL movie.
Oh, thank you for saying that. Yeah, it's everything sure. I wanted from an SNL movie.
Well, and I wanted to ask you about that. Like, when did, like, your desire to make an SNL movie like this come along? Because it feels like it came together pretty quickly.
Yeah, I mean, look, here's the thing. And I got to be a guest writer on SNL back in 2008, right. And a lot of it came out of my experience there. But even when I was younger, there always used to be this moment where they would do these bumpers, where in between sketches, there would be just, like, 2 or 3 seconds where they would show you behind the scenes,
yeah.
The camera's moving, you'd hear the person in the control room going, 3, 2, get them to makeup, 1, get that thing there. And I would go, I want more of that.
Yeah.
Can you show me more of that? And I think I've always been kind of enthralled by behind the scenes. It's why I love Michael Ritchie movies. Like, I love The Candidate and I love Smile and I love to see how, like, how things are made.
Yeah.
And I can watch, like, how things are made TikToks for, like, hours. I think it's the reason I had to remove TikTok from my phone. But getting to be at Saturday Night, at the table read, writing a sketch, on the floor as they went live.
Yeah.
I wanted audiences to be able to feel that.
I wanted to ask, there's a great moment with Gabriel Labelle as Lorne Michaels where he hones in on the director of the Rumpus Hour looking
yes.
absolutely miserable.
Yes.
And it lights this, like, new fire under
yeah.
him. Did that moment come about from a conversation you had with Lorne himself, or is that something you kind of, like, put in there as, like, to get the audience in the mindset of Lorne in those moments?
That moment happened the day of. I was just figuring that shot out because it's a long shot. It takes them all the way from the elevator through the whole Rumpus Hour up the stairs, and I felt like something was missing, and I thought, oh, you know, it'd be really interesting if Lorne saw this alternate future. Where, like, who would he be if he didn't stand up for himself?
Yeah.
Who would he be if he didn't follow his convictions? And then the funny thing is, I have to go through all the background actors and be like, who looks like failure?
Like, oh, no.
And, like, it's like maybe him sitting on that chair looking off into the middle distance.
And now that guy's just depressed forever.
What?
That's really cool. I wanted to ask, too, because I love how you utilize the laying of the bricks
yeah.
In Studio 8H.
Yeah.
And that really felt like it brings the movie together
yeah.
and, like, the cast in a whole way. Can you talk about, like, creating that moment and just realizing that was, like, such a key thing for the movie?
Certainly. You know, when I heard the fact that they actually laid bricks for home base, which is insane. Like, no one would ever do that. Like, particularly in New York, when you're shooting on the 8th floor of an office building, like, why are you laying bricks? But they had an obsession with real detail. It showed the fact that none of them had ever made TV before.
Yeah.
That the production designer came from Broadway. And I was like, yeah, we're gonna lay real bricks. And it seemed like an opportunity for these two generations to finally coalesce at the last second.
Yeah. Now, this doesn't seem like the kind of movie that warrants a follow-up or a sequel, but I feel like the different eras.
Oh my God,
SNL,
I would make 20 sequels.
Like a sequel about the Dick Ebersol years, like something in the 90s where you had the turmoil of Norm MacDonald being fired when Chris Farley died. Like,
I've never had this on set. Usually on set, like, people are like, hey, I'm having a good time, but, like, when this wraps, I'm ready to leave and go do something else. And every day, the crew is pitching me, could we do 1976? Could we do Ebersol in 1980?
Yeah.
Could we do, like, Eddie Murphy shows up? What about Will Ferrell's first date? Like, everyone is pitching, like,
there's endless possibilities.
Their version of, like, or things that happen with the music or the band
yeah.
or, like, you know. And my answer is yes. If the right idea happened, this group loved making this movie,
yeah.
and I would go do it again tomorrow.
Awesome. I would love that. Now, I spotted a box of colon blow.
Yes!
In the movie.
Yeah.
I was like, yes. Are there any other sneaky future
yes.
SNL Easter eggs?
Yes. Yeah, there's a bottle of Swill. and there's the blender that becomes the Bass-O-Matic.
Nice.
There's actually like quite a few through there.
That's phenomenal. I do want to shift gears real quickly because I'd be remiss if I didn't ask.
Yeah.
But where do you think the future lies for live-action Ghostbusters franchise after Frozen Empire? How's your perspective on how Ghostbusters moves forward?
Well, I mean, the good news is that there's an audience for it. Like, the last two movies did well. They did unbelievably well on digital. Sony is feeling really confident about it, and they are definitely... Sony would much rather me be writing Ghostbusters than 1970s movies. But look, obviously, it's... personally very rewarding when Ghostbusters is doing well. And I think about my father anytime something good happens for Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
So Gil and I are deep into getting the next step ready.
Very cool. Well, they're giving me the light, so that's my wrap.
Dude.
This
thank
was
you
awesome, man. No,
words.
Thank you so much for talking to
thank
me.
Thank you for being here.
And then Brad also had a chance to talk to three of the cast members: Gabriel LaBelle, who plays Lorne Michaels; Rachel Sennett, who plays Rosie Schuster; and Dylan O'Brien, who plays Dan Aykroyd.
All right, so I love this movie. It's fantastic. You guys are all incredible in this film. Gabe, I want to start with you to find out, because Lorne Michaels is like a presence in pop culture, like to the point where people do impressions of his voices all the time. What was your process like of figuring out how to play him and not like leaning into that caricature side of Lorne?
Ooh, I'm glad you bring that up, because he doesn't sound like those impressions. It
right.
is a caricature. And I think a lot of people asked me, like, are you going to do the Dr. Evil voice? I'm like, no, I'm not gonna, it doesn't sound like that.
Did you ever try it just for fun?
I think in Jason was great. He said he wanted us, he wanted the character to be a little inspired by Jason Schwartzman from Rushmore,
okay.
of like just a constant breeze to him in organization. But I thought, no, it was just a lot of books. I read a lot of books. Yeah, I worked on the voice, but it was just like a Canadian accent and
right.
like the cadence of his voice. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I had a lot of time to think about it. I was cast, and then both union strikes happened. So I had about a year to think about this movie before we actually started shooting. So it was just this very like slow, gradual process. Like, that was the thing to do in that time, of like figuring out how I wanted to balance it. And I just wanted to be as like, I don't know. I didn't want anything to like stick out. I
right.
wanted it all to feel comfortable.
Dylan, similarly, Dan Aykroyd has a very unique way of speaking, his cadence and the way he talks.
Yeah.
And you nailed that.
Thank you.
What was your process like of figuring that out and really like coming into Aykroyd's voice?
Thanks. I don't just listening and repeating and trying to get it right. You know, I mean, that was kind of. Yeah, that's really kind of it.
I especially liked, there's a moment when you let his vulnerability shine through, when he's feeling a bit self-conscious in
sure.
the short shorts.
Yeah.
Where did that specific moment come from? Did that come from, like, research
directed.
You did? Oh, okay, perfect.
Yeah, literally, because I would not have actually, like, credit to Jason, because, I keep getting feedback that people love that scene.
Yeah.
And I would not have approached that scene that way. I wouldn't have guessed that Dan would be embarrassed to wear the short shorts. And like I didn't feel embarrassed to have the short shorts on, so it's not how I would have done it. And he's like, no, you need to be like, he's like, I want you to be like self-conscious
yeah.
and like embarrassed. And I was like, oh, I'm so sorry. I was like, woo-hoo! I don't, that was a totally like a direction that was given to me.
Rachel, you play Rosie Schuster,
yeah.
and she obviously wasn't in the limelight as much as, you know, even Lorne,
yeah.
But she's such a key part of SNL. Was that freeing to allow your performance to just kind of not be like adhering to any specific notes or details that people were familiar with about her?
Well, it's so interesting because I feel like I really got to know her in the process of reading the script and having a conversation with her. And then I was all of a sudden like, even though I didn't know that much about her before, I was like, why doesn't everyone know about her? Like, so pissed, even though I didn't really know about her before.
Yeah.
And I feel like writers so often go underappreciated, but she's such an important, like what you said, like key part in the creation of SNL and what it is today. And so like, I think it was different for me than other people because yeah, I didn't have all these like videos to watch or like movies or whatever to go through and like get down the specific behavior. So I had a conversation with her and I just like one, like hearing her voice, hearing her laugh and like a testament to the script, like so many of the words and phrases she said on the phone were like already in the script. So yeah. That was really cool where I was like, okay, like Jason and Gil have really put in the work to like figure out her, you know, her voice and her just things she says.
Right.
And then what really struck me was like, she's so funny and smart and so cool in the face of chaos.
Yeah.
And not in a way where she's like, fuck it, I don't care. Like, it's not that, but it's like, throw anything at her, she pivots, she can catch it, she throws it back to you. Like,
yeah.
And so I think that was a big part for me with Rosie. And like, when we were putting the costume together, like, I was like, I'm gonna have a red toe. No, you never see my feet in the whole film, obviously. I'm like, look out for the red toe, guys. No, but like, I wanted to have this. I don't know. I think I just without it just sort of happened naturally where I was like, she has this more confident walk than what I have. She talks. She's like, everyone shouting. She's like, okay. Like, you know, so I think that was really fun to go into. But our initial phone conversation is what sort of led me there.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I saw in another interview, you mentioned that the area where you guys shot and everything, it wasn't set up where you guys had trailers and whatnot, but you guys all had your own, like, little dressing rooms that were filled with, like, little details that kind of informed your character's, you know, place in the story. Can you guys talk about what was in your guys' spaces that kind of, like, helped create that vibe for you?
Yeah, we had one common area of 70s furniture and ping pong tables and old records and board games and puzzles, and then we had our own dressing rooms. I had ducks on the wall, like these cool metal flying ducks. I had like a small mini kind of like poker table, high top, and I had a clock in there, and I had a couch that I could lay down on, and some really cool like great furniture that people like. It was near, I think it was in the last week of filming, and I'd like go into my dressing room and there would be like people in my room. I'm like, what are you guys doing here? They're like, oh yeah, all of this is for sale, we're seeing what we want to take. I'm like, can I have a nap please? And like take it later.
I had owl lamps in my room.
Okay.
And all I got.
Fair enough.
No, what was funny about it was I don't know if it was intentional or not, but I don't think that it could be because I didn't ever like read or see any public information that like broadcasted that Dan like was an owl guy.
Right.
But I had heard a funny story like from a friend of mine who like went to high school with his daughter and was like, I was like at their house one time and like he just walked in with like an owl on his shoulder.
There you go.
And I was like, wait, that's so crazy. I have these owl lamps in my room and I didn't think anything of it.
Yeah. And little did you know.
Little did I know.
Little did you know.
That's my
big owl guy.
Soul.
Rachel, is there anything in your space?
Rachel, you go.
My space was chic and beautiful. Honestly,
course,
I was sort of,
course,
like, yeah, this is exactly what I fucking need. And it felt, perfect for Rosie.
Yeah, you walked into my dressing room once, and you're like, yeah, this is such a boys' room.
It's great, but it wasn't my mind was like. I had this beautiful couch. It was so long. I would take these big-ass naps on it. It was just great. I had a little table. I had, like, a dressing table. It was gorgeous.
There are some really impressive long takes in this movie where it's just wandering through all of the chaos on the set. What was that like as performers, like, executing that, you know? Like, how difficult, basically, was it pulling those off?
Some were easier than others. Some, it was just like, okay, this is 5-minute one, or we all have to show up and we all have to hit our marks and be perfect. And then others kind of you discovered with the blocking, with the pacing of the dialogue, and some you may have to like, you have to leave this door, walk down the hall to open this door on time, but we found ourselves like stopping at the door for too long to like say the line. So we had to like trim the scene down and kind of work on our feet for some others. But it was really fun. It just, you had to be on edge and you had to be like really present. And I think that's like a great acting exercise of like not, of just being so generous to your environment and to the actors across from you and not being stuck in your head.
Now, I just talked to Jason a little bit ago, and even though this doesn't feel like the kind of movie that would warrant like a sequel or follow-up, there's so much rich SNL history. Is there any other moment like from throughout the SNL, you know, lore and everything that you would love to play out in a potential sequel?
Whoa.
It's a cool question.
Yeah.
There was on set, Cooper Hoffman and Andrew Feldman would joke and pitch the idea of...
Not a joke. It's greenlit.
Yeah, of Dick and Neil. Andrew Barth Feldman plays Neil Levy, who is Lorne Michaels' cousin and assistant in the first episode. And once Lorne leaves after 5 years, they are the head authorities of the show. And it would just be very funny how Neil, who is at the bottom of the totem pole in terms of power on in this film, how he would be on like a power trip. And... because he hired Eddie Murphy,
right?
And because he just said, make me laugh. So he thought it would be a very funny thing that Andrew all of a sudden is like this big wig suit.
Yeah.
I think that would be great.
Yeah, I didn't know that there were years that Lorne left the show. So yeah. That was cool to find out about.
Quite tumultuous,
and that Neil, and that Neil hired Eddie Murphy. It's like cool.
Yeah.
It's cool
to know. Anything from you guys as far as what you might like to act out for in a potential sequel?
Oh. Well, I'd be in that one, right?
Yeah, I'd be in that too.
Yeah.
We stuck around.
Yeah.
So we'd be in that. And we'd be doing press with Andrew Barth Feldman right now.
And not you.
And we will.
Brutal.
Yeah.
No, it's not brutal. It's okay.
It's life. It's
okay.
A business.
It happens.
Hey, it's a tough business.
Listen, but it's show business. Yeah.
Show
your head up.
Cave
okay,
is okay.
You played Spielberg and Lorne Michaels.
Yeah, yeah.
You'll have more wins.
You'll get another job.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey,
right.
You'll work again.
I'm pretty sure.
Maybe one day.
And finally, we will wrap things up with Brad's chat with co-writer Gil Keenan.
So I wanted just to start off as kind of set the stage here. You've been working with Jason Reitman for a little while now, but how did your collaborative relationship really begin?
Well, we've been friends for a really long time. We met as you would expect us to have met, which is lacing up ice skates in a locker room, waiting for a scrimmage match of an ice hockey game. And that was when both of us were making our very first film. So I was making Monster House and Jason was making Thank You for Smoking. And we really just struck up a conversation that has sort of kept going now for 20 years. That stayed as a sort of a casual friendship that then developed into storytelling really organically. We just started going on road trips, and then we started to talk specific stories, screenplays. We collaborated on an animated screenplay that was sort of just us kind of getting our gears turning. And SNL was a story that we started talking about a really long time ago. This was sort of something that, you know, Jason had this, well, first of all, I should say both of us were raised on Saturday Night Live. I mean, I'm pretty sure I learned how to program my parents' VCR in order to be able to record Saturday Night Live because I couldn't stay up late enough, but I would watch it as a Sunday morning ritual with my brother. And that sort of tradition has kept going since I was a little kid. So this really informed a big part of my comic language and storytelling language. But we started talking about this sort of on our road trips. And for Jason, the experience was a little bit more sharpened because after Juno, he had the experience of going for a week to sort of shadow and write on the show. And I think that for him really crystallized a kind of the same level of excitement that I had, but he had a front row seat to it. So we started to talk about what it was like to put that show on and started to imagine what it must have been like that first night when nobody really knew what the show was going to be. No one knew whether it would be a success, whether it would find an audience. But this group of legends, and they sort of forked out to becoming sort of cultural forces of their own. Each of the folks involved with that first episode, it just started to take on a life of its own. And we obviously wrote a couple of Ghostbusters films together, and the first one, Ghostbusters Afterlife, was really our first produced screenplay together. It was in the wake of that, before that film came out, but after it had sort of been shot, that we started to talk very seriously about making this story a screenplay that we would sink our teeth into. And then the pandemic hit, and we found ourselves with a sort of perfect captive audience, which was every single person who we could get our hands on who worked on that first episode. And we just started this, for me, absolutely eye-opening, incredible, joyful series of conversations.
I wanted to ask about that process of, like, what was it really like to figure out what you wanted to include in that 90 minutes leading up? Because I'm sure every crew member, every person there, you know, has their own perspective on what happened and how things went. What was it like to really dig in and start breaking it down and figure out what those key moments were?
Well, one of the cool things about starting this project off is that we didn't really have any preconceived notions of what the narrative was going to be. I mean, we knew it was going to end with Live from New York at Saturday night. Spoiler alert, but that for us was actually like the basic premise of the shape of the thing. But within the runtime of our story, we sort of kept ourselves really open and neutral to seeing how the relationships and stories that we were told were going to shape the narrative. And so what that meant was that we sort of came at it with a clean slate. And as we started to build up our understanding of what was going on that night, where everyone was, and we actually did sort of create mental maps of where people were at various points in the building. This was a really complicated screenplay to assemble because we not only had to track like 80 something speaking characters, but we also had to sort of track things like the sofa that catches on fire and then another sofa that is retrieved from the writer's floor and brought down to 8H and then ends up on screen. And these sort of things began to create almost like a mesh. And that mesh of moving characters, animals, barnyard animals that are inexplicably in the corridors, and specific props, furniture, sketch concepts that are being exercised, all of these kind of began to come up like you would raise a barn. And one day we sort of looked at what we had and realized that enough skeleton, enough superstructure was there for us to start kind of really honing down and then sinking our teeth into.
Yeah, that's incredible because, like, you also produced the movie in addition to writing it. And, like, I was curious what it was like, especially because you have all these cool long single takes that are just moving in and out all of the hallways and mazes of Studio 8H, what it was like to kind of wrangle all that and know where everybody is at any given time.
I mean, it was, so it's a kind of blessing and a curse, right? The curse is that it's incredibly complicated, both in terms of scheduling and planning. I mean, it's a good thing that this is Jason's 10th movie, not his second or God forbid first, because his experience and confidence really showed in being able to sort of bite off these really complex long sequences. Also, our AD Shelley is a genius and was able to create a framework that allowed so many characters to be on stage at any one time. The blessing also comes with the sort of entire ethos of this production. And it's one of the things that both made this possible and I think it is one of the things that makes the movie feel so alive to an audience, is that there's no artifice here. I mean, we just built 8H. It's a full soundstage. It's a multi-story set that allowed the camera and the performers and now the audience to move through this place without having to worry about where the edges of the frame are. And what it does is innumerable in creating an environment of storytelling, both for us as filmmakers and for the audience experiencing it, where something just feels like it's real, and it you can't help but feel like you're getting pulled into that world. It was an absolutely incredible stage to be on, and I've never been on a film set that's felt so close to the subject of the story that is being told on the set. The energy, the way the thing was filmed, the looseness of it, the sort of camaraderie of it, not a giant crew, but an expert one. Everyone really worked together to capture that spirit.
That's awesome. Yeah. And I love just kind of, it constantly just feels like a fly on the wall movie. And like my favorite things too are like, just the little runners that keep happening throughout everything. Like you have Neil coming out and just always being like, you know, 25 minutes at any given moment. And the guy who's also walking around with the incense, I especially
Tom Schiller. Yeah.
I love when Gabe grabs the incense from Tom and just quickly puts it around him and then just keeps walking.
He's got one of my favorite things about Lorne and Tom and his new age practices is that Lorne has no judgment. You know, he spent time on the West Coast. He really he accepts it. In fact, he embraces it when the moment is right. I mean, those are two examples: the Tom incense runner and the Neil Levy countdown runner are both two concepts that we just had no idea about before we interviewed both of those folks. The Neil Levy thing, we just thought we were being completists when we talked to Neil, who is Lauren's nephew, or Lauren's cousin, sorry. We really felt like we were just kind of completing our mental map of who was there that night. And in talking to Neil, a character just started to materialize. By the end of that interview, we realized we had something we could really use to create a sense of momentum, comic momentum for our story. And yeah. Tom's an amazing character. I actually just revisited our interview with him. I wish he could have, I mean, this is actually the thing about that made writing it both so thrilling and complicated. Sorry, I'm getting another call, but it's gone now. Is that we had to make really hard choices about who to focus our energy with. Like Tom Schiller deserves a whole movie about him, him as a character. He had an incredible run on the show. He ended up sort of taking over the film segments, became the guy who created these iconic SNL short film concepts after the Albert Brooks era ended. Ended up having a feature career. He's a real personality. Anyway, so this was one of the things is like we ended up having a bounty of stories. And our job, and you know, both relying on our own experience as filmmakers, and also just starting to focus this in on Lorne, was about creating a sort of coherent and propulsive shape to it.
Yeah, I talked to Jason earlier today, and I asked him about this, and he was immediately in. And even though this movie doesn't seem like it lends itself to like a sequel, because it's pretty, you know, beginning and there's so, you know, the history, there's so many eras where like wild things happen. Like you can do like the Dick Ebersol years, you know, like all the stuff that happened like in the 90s. Do you have any interest in like tackling another specific part of SNL history for another movie?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, there is high drama in SNL. It's actually stayed high stakes for nearly every season. We did entertain the idea before the sets were torn down, because they were so cool and so one-to-one what exists in New York. The grim reality of filmmaking is you always have to tear it down and build it back up again. But the answer is yes, it is a ripe premise or world for further storytelling. But I'm sure Jason also told you that this movie finished shooting like weeks ago. So yes. the paint is still wet on this movie.
Yeah, funnily enough, he did say that this was the one though where like usually he's happy to be done, but like this one he wanted to like keep doing more, you know?
It was a pretty special shoot, and it was quick, but such a, when you build the right, sort of production, when you have the right cast, and when everyone feels sort of committed to the task at hand, you don't want to leave it. And that feeling was very much present on set. The only solace we had is that we knew we were about to go put this movie together and that we'd get to keep living with that thing forever. But yeah, it was a special one.
Do you have a certain era that is like your era of SNL that you just love, like your favorite era?
Yeah, I mean, I think that everyone's sort of this is an age-dependent matrix, I think, but I'm definitely the Chris Farley years. So basically, Dana Carvey, Mike Myers, Chris Farley, and then extending out. I mean, I still watch every week. So I feel like that was just for me the beginning of the flood. The waters have not receded.
Yeah, 100%. I'm right there with you. I did want to dig a little bit into Ghostbusters because you're obviously running the ship now with Jason and working at Ghost Corps. And after Frozen Empire, you have such a large roster of characters. And so I was wondering kind of like what the future looks like for Ghostbusters. Does there ever come a time when like the legacy characters retire and like truly pass the baton? You know, how do you see Ghostbusters moving forward from here?
No, we just make 5-hour movies. It's easy as that. Look, first of all, it's been a hell of a year. I just can't believe that Jason and I started this year by bringing this sort of massive Ghostbusters movie of the world, and now here we are, not quite at the end with our Saturday night film. And I'm just so super proud of the stories that we've been able to tell together. Yeah, the world of ghostbusting, first of all, we started it with Afterlife way out in Oklahoma so that we could bring it back to New York City. So we feel really, really satisfied that ghostbusting is now back where it belongs. And we are working actively on building out the world of Ghostbusters. It's not necessarily always going to be full, the full complement of characters. But until we've written the next one, and until I know exactly where that next story is going to go, I can't sort of prognosticate about exactly when the OGs are going to finally go off and golf and leave the ghost busting to the kids.
Yeah.
That inevitably that moment is going to happen, but I don't know when it's going to be.
Now you started your feature career directing Monster House, which I also love too. And
Thanks.
I wanted to know if you had any interest in returning to animation, maybe even doing an animated Ghostbusters movie. I know you guys have an animated TV show in the works,
Yeah.
but like, I always wondered if there was room for something like a real Ghostbusters stylized, like, Spider-Verse animation or anything like that.
So the answer to the first question is yes. Animation is still one of my main modes of storytelling. I think about animation, as part of my process of telling a film. I think of the storyboarding process that I go through on every film to be sort of half of the animation, maybe one quarter of the animation process. And then the rest sort of just is completed with actors. But I absolutely would return to animation. And I feel like one of the things that was important to me with Monster House was sort of breaking the boundaries of what the perceived themes that you could explore in animation were, at least in sort of mainstream kind of studio animation at that point. And I definitely would want my next animated film to push even further in that direction because I love the medium so much, and I think it's an incredible way to build worlds and to create emotion for an audience. So the answer is yes, and I hope to put my writing energy into something in that direction soon. For I'll speak for a second about the Ghostbusters animated universe, just to say that the artwork that has been generated and as it is being created for our Netflix series is so cool and so cinematic that for me, it sort of answers the question of how else we would bring the Ghostbusters universe to life in animation. I absolutely am open to us creating a feature length Ghostbusters animated story, and I love your idea. But I feel like in the immediate present, that itch is being scratched in a big way.
Okay, cool. I'm sure you and Jason have your hands full with Ghost Core, but are there any other franchises that you might be interested in dipping your toes into?
No, the answer is we have our hands full right now, and in the best possible way. I think the balance between Ghostbuster storytelling, which is a franchise that, you know, thematically, tonally, its ability to move between big audience horror and big audience comedy, it's just so in the middle of our crosshairs in terms of the kinds of big movies we both want to make, and knowing that we have that and are able to create more personal films like Saturday Night is a sort of best case scenario for me and for Jason right now. So we feel like we're in a really good place, and we just want to keep telling stories that we feel passionate about.
Right on. Cool. Well, that's my time. I really appreciate it, Gil. It was great to talk to you. And man, I loved Saturday Night so much. I'm a diehard fan, and yeah, this movie's incredible. I'm so happy.
So grateful. It's really good to talk to you. Thanks so much. And I'll see you around.
Cool. Thanks a lot, Gil.
All right, that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find more about Saturday Night, including Brad's review, at slashfilm.com. I will link to it in the show notes as well. Slashfilm Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really helps out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Transform your home in one weekend with paint from Menards. Get a paint that combines durability and gorgeous color. Dutch Boys Forever Interior Paint and Primer in One offers powerhouse protection with its stain-blocking, odor-reducing technology. And with Dutch Boys Easy Opening Smooth Pouring Container, transforming your home has never been easier. View our entire selection of Dutch Boy paint on Menards.com. Plus the weekly flyer and other great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.